for those who know every line, and for those finding Star Wars for the very first time, welcome to Growing Up Skywalker.
Welcome to Growing Up Skywalker. My name is Anna.
And I'm Sam.
It is 8 a.m., pajama time, Sunday morning, and we are talking about a really, like, not cozy episode of Andor, but a really good episode of Andor.
No parts of this episode are cozy.
So little. No, you're right. Nothing. I got nothing. We're recapping Andor Season 1, Episode 5, The Axe Forgets. Everyone is tense. Mm-hmm. Nobody is having fun.
No one's sleeping. No one's eating.
No one's showering. They're grubby. They're grimy. They're anxious. Hashtag relatable.
Let's get into it. Real quick, before we begin, we want to acknowledge that SAG-AFTRA is still on strike. There's very important concessions that actors need with regards to their identities and their royalties moving forward, because that's how they can make a living. And if we want to have new upcoming actors, these concessions are going to need to be met one way or the other. So we want to hold a moment open for them in solidarity. And we also want to urge, once again, skipping the walkthrough, the whole industry is together on this and there's a path forward. So we're looking forward to resolving that, similar to how the writers were able to resolve their strike.
Solidarity forever.
Heck yeah.
Very exciting. Since Growing Up Skywalker is not a union podcast, we did watch Andor this week. And I'm going to do a lightning round. Let's recap everyone who's not the Cassian Andor plot, and then we can talk about the Cassian Andor plot. What
okay.
do you think?
Sounds good. Where
okay.
are we starting?
Okay. We're starting with, I'm going to start with the I plot for Imperials.
Okay. The ISB plot. What is Deidre and the Deidre Tones up to?
So Deidre and the Deidre Tones is an amazing band name. Please trademark that immediately. I'm going to go start a girl band. Thank you for that. The name is the hardest part. And learning musical instruments. Okay, I plot for Imperials. We actually go back to Ferrix for the first time in a minute.
Yes.
The Imperials are all over town. They're making all of the townspeople clean up after the big shootout from when Luthen and Cassian blasted their way out of town.
Mm-hmm.
Blevin, what is his – he's a lieutenant? Blevin, who we know as the sort of arch nemesis of Lieutenant Miro – he's in town. He installs a new Imperial prefect there, which I'm guessing is like a new governor.
Yeah. The dude is like, can I be made prefect? And Belvin's like, I literally do not care what you call yourself.
You could wear suspenders and boots and nothing else for all I care.
He literally says you could wear a ball gown. And it's like, okay, so this is how much you actually care. It's impactful, but it's not really particularly meaningful at this time.
Right. And neither, to be fair, is this little plot thread. All we know is that the imps are cracking down on Ferrix, and that's all we get. We then follow along with Deidre Miro, who, in the course of tracking down the lost Starpath unit from her base that Cassian stole, she is actually connecting all of the threads of a semi-organized rebellion. So she has this kind of amazing, high-powered, overachieving assistant who really believes in this theory of hers.
Mm-hmm.
So they're in her office. They're popping Red Bull tabs. They are combing through files. They're doing the conspiracy meme of connecting the colored yarn on their corkboard. And they're connecting the dots of this stolen equipment all over the galaxy. Because they think this is the rebels trying to be sneaky.
They say it's too random to be random. And they're referencing a bunch of other things, including a prisoner escape on Kessel, which is the pilot of Rebels.
Oh, I didn't even catch that.
It's a bunch of stuff spread all over. It's great.
Yeah. So Miro, like, pop some more caffeine tabs, and she's like, if I were the rebels, this is how I do it. Never climb the same fence twice. And I'm rooting for her because girl boss. And I'm also like, Deidre Miro, stop being good at your job. Thank you. Yeah. So that's the entire Imperial plot. Then we have the M plot for Mothma.
Mm-hmm. The whole Mothma family is meeting for breakfast.
It's not a great breakfast meeting. I'll tell you that for nothing. We find out Mothma Mon, I should say, has a daughter. She is a daddy's girl.
Mm-hmm.
He has turned her against her cool mom, which I find very hurtful. And I'm not even Mon Mothma.
Mon Mothma also finds it hurtful. And the daughter, Leda, is like, of course it's all about you. And Mon Mothma's like, okay, fine. I'm just leaving. I'm just going to my charity brunch alone.
Alone. Ugh. Later in the evening, she and Perrin, her terrible husband, are coming back from a ball in their beautiful limousine. And we find out that Mon has invented a charity to front for the money that she's trying to get to the rebels, which is very clever, but Perrin does not seem convinced by this.
I had a different read. Perrin was hurt that he's like, I was talking with, I don't know, some dude, Gar something, and he knows more about what you're up to than I do. And Mon Mothma's like, well, of course, this new charitable foundation, it's a charity. You wouldn't care about that. And Perrin's like, look, maybe not, but I would, you know.
Look, just tell me you think I'm a scuzzbag. Like, you don't have to veil it.
Yeah.
Just,
Or it seems like he wants in on her stuff. So I don't know. It was an interesting moment.
It was a teeny tiny touch base. We get a similar kind of touch base on the S plot for Cyril.
Poor freaking Cyril.
Freaking disgraced Cyril Karn has gone from storming Ferrix with a bunch of soldiers to eating blue milk Lucky Charms at his mom's kitchen table.
And it is the most toxic relationship ever. It is hilarious.
She is 4 feet tall. She is deeply overbearing. She has a Star Wars deep New York accent. And she is very concerned about his future.
And so she's calling in the family favor from Uncle Harlow.
The family favor. She literally said, Cyril Karn, you are 27 years old. You have no money, no prospects. You are already a burden on your parent, which is me. And I'm frightened for you. I'm calling in the singular family favor.
Like the scene starts off and she's berating him for having poor posture. And he like is sitting there just eating his cereal. And then he like picks it up and throws it back in the bowl. He is having the worst time.
Now we know why Cyril Karn is the way he is.
Oh my gosh.
So the culmination for his little plot is that as Uncle Harlow is deciding what Karn should do with his life, he's just sitting in his childhood bedroom stewing over Cassian's hologram and dreaming up revenge and how to restore his tarnished reputation.
Yep.
That's the touch bases we get. Then we should probably get into the main plot.
The A plot for Andor.
So this is kind of an atmospheric episode. It's another episode where everyone is pieces on a chessboard and they're all splayed out and they're all getting moved into their places. So we open up on the rebel camp where Andor and everyone are staked out waiting for the meteor storm. We get a bunch of fascinating insights into why everyone has joined this rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of stuff with Skeen and his brother and I guess being conscripted into the Imperial Army.
We mostly learn that Skeen is covered in gang tattoos, which the other rebels don't recognize, but Andor does.
That's what those were.
He's like, oh, you were in prison gangs.
Okay, let's talk about that later. It kind of helps Clem, quote unquote Clem, and Skeen to bond and kind of not. We also learn that Nemec is a true hot-blooded, philosophical rebel anarchist with big ideas about imperial repression.
And a manifesto.
We stan a manifesto king with pure ideals, not the other ones. We don't claim them.
We also learn that he has a jam-proof manual. It looks like a Polaroid camera, but it's not navigational aid that only he knows how to use. That's really important.
Perhaps even more importantly, we learn that the crew has literally no idea what to do with the freighter. So let's back up. Their plot is that they're breaking into the Imperial Armory. They are grabbing the entire quarter's payroll, and they're yeeting into an old freighter. And then Cassian is supposed to take off into the eye of the meteor storm, which is literally called the Eye. That's happening tomorrow night. Except they're asking Cassian a bunch of questions about how to do the job. And he's like, wait, do you not know how to pull off this job? What were you going to do if I wasn't here?
Cassian immediately shows his value in that scene because he's meeting with Tamarin and Vel, who are like the leaders. And he's like, look, you can say it's your idea, but I'm flying this thing. If it's my butt on the line, I'm flying it. And then we see another scene where they're drilling as soldiers and Cassian can march just fine. And he's like, you two should switch places. And they're like, why? And he says, because he's left-handed. And Vel's like, well, what am I? And he's like, right-handed, right-handed, shoots left, favors right, left-handed, right-handed, right-handed. We got to switch this up. And that's like the attention to actual detail. And everyone who like is a decision maker, which is Vel and Tamarin, are like, yeah, he's right.
Yeah, turns out Cassian is going to be very important to the success of this plan. Mm-hmm. If they are successful at all, which, you know, we're kind of crossing our fingers at this point.
Yeah.
That night, they burn all of the evidence, the beautiful scale model that Nemec put together.
I think he's all right with it.
I think he's fine. He's a big boy. And in the morning, they hike out. Things come to a head when Skeen sees Cassian's kyber crystal that Luthen gave him around his neck. Everyone turns on him, and he has to confess that he is a mercenary. He's being paid. If they have a problem, they need to take it up with Vel. And then everyone turns on Vel for not telling them.
Well, Cassian also diffuses the situation because he says, are you afraid? Because I'm afraid. It's the day before the op. Everyone's like, if you're going to back out, back out. Don't blame me. I'm in it. I am aware of my fears. Fear, I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Join me in defeating this. I'm in it to win it. It doesn't matter why I'm here. So, like, check in with yourselves before you worry about me.
Mm-hmm. Things settle down just a little bit by the time they get to the camp overlooking the armory that night. Vel and Cinta hike off into the darkness to get something ready. We don't know what it is. Tamarin takes charge of the mission. Everything is in place. And then we finally cut to Luthen in his beautiful art gallery back room on Coruscant, very nervous for the mission tomorrow. If the rebels are caught, not only will Vel trace back to him, but now Cassian will trace back to him because of the kyber crystal. So he and Clea have bug out bags ready, and they're gonna be watching the game on their iPads while the clients are here tomorrow, ready to get out of town, hop into the Fonder, and scoot. And so we end this episode with this like anxious, nervous anticipation about what happens tomorrow.
Clea says, it'll all be over this time tomorrow. And Luthen says, or just beginning.
And that's episode 5 of Andor.
So once again, I'm realizing as we're watching through that we've got these little triplicate arcs of each. There's like 4 little trilogies in season 1 of Andor. And this is a middle episode, so it's a little slow.
It reminded me a lot of episode 2.
Yeah. Yeah. But we do have the tension ratcheting up, particularly around Cassian's relationship with the rest of the heist crew.
Yeah. Okay. So we were, this is a little bit of an anecdote. We were at your sister's house for dinner this week. We're celebrating the engagement and we're talking about all of the new Star Wars shows. And they were talking about how by this point in Andor, Andor had lost them. It didn't give them the Star Wars feeling that they were looking for and they were bored. And first of all, hashtag cannot relate to that. But also, I think they were kind of saying, Cassian is the least interesting person on his own show. And I was feeling that until this episode.
I agree. He is the least interesting person in almost all the episodes up until this one, because in this one, he shows what Luthen saw.
Yeah.
Which is someone who, like, joins your heist and tells you two to switch places because that is what the natural thing would be. Mm-hmm. And you've just been doing it without this understanding of what it meant to be a soldier. And Cassian's like, I don't even need to have been a soldier to know what's up.
Well, except according to Cassian's backstory, we parceled out a little bit more of his backstory with the interaction with Skeen. Mm-hmm. What was Cassian talking about that he was doing when he was 13?
He was in a juvenile detention facility.
Okay. I thought he was in the army, but he was in prison.
So when the scene, the A-plot opens up and Cassian wakes up in his hammock and he's the last one up and he looks over and his stuff is gone and Skeen has it all laid out on the table and is like cleaning it out and checking it and just interrogating him. He's like, corporate blaster, this is all you brought with you, this plus your wound, you're like, you don't have your stuff together.
You're on the run.
Yeah, which is correct. But then he says, oh, you recognize this. None of those other fools did. This is like a crate head prison gang tattoo.
And then like the five finger or something. Yeah.
So he recognizes in Cassian someone who knows what's up with him as far as like, yeah, we are criminals. We're not like... Like, Nemec is sitting there being like, I will put my life on the line to break the Empire, but I'm going to do it through hearts and minds. And Skeen and Cassian are like, we've been caught a couple times. And we do it, and this is where the episode title comes from. The axe forgets, but the tree remembers. Skeen says that to Cassian because he's referring to how the school-to-prison pipeline in the Empire is breeding a whole generation of people who hate the Empire.
Ooh. So when Skeen said that, I was trying to figure out if that was a phrase that was supposed to mean something to Cassian or if it was just meaningful in and of itself.
I think it's meaningful later because as apology for holding a knife to his throat and stealing his Kyber crystal necklace in a moment when it was not okay to do so.
there was no consent to be had.
Yeah, there's really no moment that that's all right. Skeen tells Cassian his backstory and said, I had a brother. The Imperial Prefect took his tree farm, and my brother was so heartbroken, he filled his pockets with rocks and jumped into the lake. And that's, it makes sense that Skeen would have a tree-related metaphor for something dark,
if that's the case. Oh, maybe it was something that his brother said to him.
It's also a really important thing in my personal backstory, reminding me of just like, what trauma is, because when I have gone about making things right in my life with like, you know, my siblings, my parents, past people, when I say, hey, this is what I did to you. And they're like, I literally don't remember that, but I do remember this. I'm like, oh boy, I literally don't remember that.
Mm.
So what is impactful in your interactions with people is not always what you think.
Yeah, and memory is subjective.
It is.
Interesting. I want to touch on that point that you said. This was very meaningful when you were talking about how the youth to prison pipeline has bred an entire generation of rebels mm-hmm. or an entire generation of people who hate the Empire. And I was thinking a lot about how much this episode has to say about grassroots rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
And I got that a lot with Skeen and a lot with Nemec.
Nemec is so great.
Nemec has so many pearls of wisdom to drop.
Yeah, he's absolutely great. So Nemec brings up an interesting point that is deeply rooted in the modern like right to repair and the copylefting movements, where he's like, this is the most reliable navigational tool ever devised. I can fit it in my pocket. It requires training. And now everything is licensed for like a monthly fee from the Empire.
So it's basically like he pulls out an analog pocket watch.
Yeah.
And the equivalent is everyone's wearing a Fitbit. And he's like, No, you don't understand. If you can learn how to read this pocket watch, this analog piece of tech, yes, it takes more energy. Yes, it takes training. And then you're free.
Yeah.
And you never have to rely on the empire ever again. And you can subvert them from underground. So you have to free yourself from the trappings. It was very Audre Lorde, right? The master's house will never be dismantled with the master's tools.
Yeah. Yeah. And he says something, he says a few things to that effect. Everything he says is so impactful as far as being like a true revolutionary who believes in self-determination and how the real problem of the empire is that, first of all, they commit 40 atrocities a day. So you can't, like, it's just too much. You get fatigued. But the other one is, then they install underneath that so that you're fatigued from the atrocities. You forget that your rights are being taken away. And he says things in the verbiage of a founding father without using it exactly in the way we would see it, because presumably there's no constitution or, you know, Declaration of Independence.
I'm sure the Empire has one. I'm sure nobody likes it.
Well, I mean, maybe there's perfectly functioning countries without constitutions, but saying, he says there are, he basically says there are inalienable rights, which we all have.
Mm-hmm.
And that is revolutionary. And that
in a very American sense, too.
Well, in an Enlightenment sense, because the Enlightenment era of the 1700s also corresponds with a freedom that arose from the ability to rapidly travel around the globe, because problems of navigation had been solved. And that's why he has these two things as his touchstones. He has his manifesto and he has his space compass. He says, these are the truths that you need, is your own self-determination and a way to get there.
Mm. Yes. What also stuck with me was this one line where he said, the pace of repression outstrips our ability to understand it.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
With that coupled with his point about like the imperial thought machine, their trick is that they hide behind 40 atrocities rather than a single incident. And those two things combined, if that's not Trumpism in a nutshell.
Yeah. I mean, that's fascism in general. And that is how these things work. There's a famous it was the 80s or 90s, and an evangelical preacher wanted to debate me atheists. And so he got a stage, and I believe it was on PBS, and he debated them. And he did what's called the Gish Gallop, where he just lied and lied and lied and lied. And he lied so fast that you can't fact check him.
Wow.
And this fact checking is such a valuable thing that is like impossible to do in real time, because what is said right now is what matters. I remember very clearly watching some of the 2016 debates and having like an absolutely traumatic moment in a laundromat as I'm watching Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton debate and being like, there is no way people are going to believe that's a truth.
Yeah.
And then
they did.
And then my parents were like, yeah, but this about Hillary. I'm like, what?
I was in a bar watching it happen in real time.
Yeah.
It was awful.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is the pace of atrocities outspeeding our ability to cope. And that is one of the fundamental things with fascism. There's that famous poem about first they came for XYZ. Mm-hmm. Like that is all what it comes down to, because as humans, we do need time to recognize that we have been traumatized, and not all of us. I mean, it's not wise for all of us to be reacting to everything immediately. Sometimes we need to build a groundswell of something.
And that's what I was thinking about, especially because I think this episode is contrasting people's settings so beautifully. So I was actually thinking about how on Ferrix, now that Lieutenant Blevin is trying to reestablish control, he's keeping the townspeople busy. He's making them scrub graffiti off of the walls. He's making them work in the streets and repair all of the damage that was done to keep them busy so they don't have time to process what happened, which is that they had a quiet revolt against the empire. And then you contrast that to the rebels, who we keep having these extended scenes of them hiking, clicks and clicks and clicks across the Scottish Highlands. Mm-hmm. And all they have time to do is think.
Yeah.
And that's why you get real thinkers, people like Nemec. But it's also why you have people like Skeen festering about Cassian. Because all they have to do is walk and think, right? So they have the freedom to counteract the Imperial thought machine. And then it also has the side effect of making them turn against each other.
Because they're paranoid and weird, but they're also isolated.
Yeah. So it's kind of a blessing and a curse.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like the people on Ferrix are too busy to be able to really process what's happening to them. And the rebel camp can. And then because the human brain is such a nefarious instrument, they're getting a little bit sidetracked. Mm-hmm. It's just interesting.
This was a super impactful episode as far as the nature of birth of rebellion and birth of thought.
Oh my gosh. When Nemec says the TIE fighter swoops over them and it's so loud, and the Imperial is doing it to intimidate them because they just look like shepherds.
Yeah.
And Nemec turns to Cassian and he's like, don't worry. Surprise from above is never as shocking as surprise from below.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, this show loves rebellion and really has done the homework on what rebellion looks like and feels like and where it comes from. Mm-hmm. And it comes from generations of people all having different reasons to hate the fascist regime. You have Skeen, who hated the regime from being in prison and then hated them for killing his brother. Mm-hmm. And then you have Nemec, who is just a deep thinker and has thought his way around this. And then you have Andor, who has a hundred different reasons. And then you have Lieutenant Gorn.
We kind of glossed over what Lieutenant Gorn is up to. He's definitely part of the rebels, but because he's the inside man and he runs the garrison, he's doing pretty crazy stuff. Like he's berating his men and he's so mean to them. And it's like he's looking for this rebound effect of saying, like, this is not going to be done. You guys are going to miss the meteorologic event. And like, look, the only reason we're here is because we want to see the Eye of Aldani. He's like, all right, but it better be done day after tomorrow.
And they're like, thank you, Lieutenant Gorn. And he walks off grinning.
He walks off not quite great. He's smizing, you know, he's scowling, he's scowling and smizing at the same time because he needs to look like that was a poor trade for him when in reality he's like, I am tricking all these guys, even if they don't want to. It's like, oh, well, would I prefer an extra work detail or would I prefer to watch the Eye of Aldani? Even if I'm neutral to the Eye of Aldani, I want to not be working.
Lieutenant Gorn is touring the facility and picking up slack. It is incredible. But we also find out that he fell in love with a native Aldani woman. Mm-hmm. He lost out on a promotion because of it. And then the Empire killed his lover anyway.
Yeah.
So what I was thinking about is why I keep coming back to Tarkin's Doctrine of Fear, because I love that you brought it up and I love that it's so relevant. And I love that this rebellion is working because Tarkin's Doctrine of Fear cannot crush a grassroots rebellion.
Yeah.
Because everyone's reasons for rebelling are as numerous as their personalities, as their backgrounds, as their traumas. Mm-hmm. And it's in the nature of the Empire to not be able to resist bringing this up in people.
You know, it's funny because one of the weaknesses of a totalitarian regime, it doesn't tolerate formal dissent.
Yeah.
And so that is basically what modern democracies are, is like, you know, I think your 5-cent tax on titanium goes too far, and I think your 6-cent tax on titanium doesn't go too far enough. Like, there's really no difference in terms of supporting the current power structure between any parties anywhere in any country. But when you have a totalitarian, authoritarian, centralized regime, they can't have like an opposition. The opposition is completely neutered. And that means that there's no place for those voices to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's think back to Gal Travis.
Mm-hmm.
And how he was like the voice of rebellion, but he's actually a honeypot. And so all of the rebels, erstwhile rebels, are like, yeah, let me track down Gaul Travis. And then ISB agents are like, by the way, 50 years hard labor.
Mm-hmm.
But here, it's so cracked down that people are coming from multiple different directions. And instead of being inspired by someone or some cause, these people are all absolute true believers because the someone and some cause is inside themselves.
Yeah. And it's interesting how they get to become true believers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it takes a certain kind of personality to not get beaten down and fester. And I think we see that with Skeen and his brother. Skeen's brother had all of the same reasons to hate the Empire, but he turned it inside of himself. He internalized it. He killed himself
mm-hmm.
instead of rise up. And then Skeen saw that and said, no, I'm going to turn this into a flame inside of myself and find something. And it's like you turn something from inside yourself into something bigger.
Yep.
Like the spark inside of yourself, you turn it into the candle that is the rebellion. What am I trying to describe here?
It's the spark which ignites the fires of rebellion. Now, I think you're making sense here. I think another person who is following a very similar Skeen and Skeen brother related plot is Mon Mothma.
Ooh, okay, explain that.
Because she leaves Luthen's Antiquities and then she has to go back and return Perrin's gift. And then she returns and her daughter is like, Dad said I don't have to. And Mon Mothma's like, I'm literally a senator. I'm basically doing this for you. And her daughter says, no, you're doing this for you.
We don't even know what they're going to – I thought she was just going to drop her daughter off at school or whatever.
It felt like it was a daughter – like a maybe a bruncheon for dispossessed people somewhere or something.
Dude, that sounds amazing.
I know.
I want Mon Mothma to be my mom and take me to brunch. Are you kidding?
But then teen daughter Leda Mothma is like, no, I – no.
Shut up, Leda.
Yeah.
I have zero tolerance for bratty teenagers.
Because you were so well behaved. But we're left with this idea of she is so in it alone. And it felt like Perrin was kind of throwing her a lifeline.
Really?
I got that vibe that he's like, I want to be more involved with what you're doing. Because I'm sure he knows. He's like, there's no reason why my wife, who is a senator, would be so grouchy at me for bringing home like all of the extra things I do. I'm doing like all of the politicking here. And I understand that my wife is in this, the opposition to the government, because she's always like, what about these dispossessed people and all that jazz? But he's all about the real politic. He's like, maybe we can reduce suffering as opposed to stop it outright.
That's such a generous read of Perrin Mothma. And I'm not being quite like I normally am. A lot of times I do the generous read of the text.
You already called him a banana head and that's game over.
There's no coming back.
There's no coming back.
See, because I read Perrin Mothma so differently.
Uh-huh.
I love hearing what you read into him, because I read that he is deeply suspicious and he's tired of first husbanding.
Mm-hmm.
I read that he has intentionally turned their daughter against Mon, just as another tool of spousal warfare. And then they're sitting in this limousine and he is questioning her because he's suspicious about what she's actually doing. And if he finds out enough information, he's going to turn her over to her political enemies.
What does he get out of that, though?
Spite.
I don't know if that's a... Because he would lose everything.
Maybe they have a prenup and he gets everything in the divorce.
Maybe. But...
maybe he's on her life insurance policy.
I think that Leda is talking with Perrin about like, hey, you're my teenage daughter and like, here's how to interact with people. He's trying to train her to be a political animal. And she's seeing that in Mon Mothma. And I think that... there is an element of sympathy there that perhaps Mon Mothma is not a perfect saint.
I am picking that up from her family, but mm-hmm. I kind of just read that as their general resentment for her not being around yeah. and always having to put on her political mask. What I am noticing a lot in the Mon Mothma scenes are the use of space. Mm-hmm. Not just her beautiful, spacious, palatial house, which is stunning, gorgeous, and amazing set
piece. Not actual space, because it's all just cars and dinners.
Right. Yeah, I don't mean galactic space. I mean like literal space, molecules between her and the people okay, she loves.
Good. Thanks for that clarification.
You're welcome. Because like think about the chauffeur limousine scene. Mm-hmm. Mon is on the extreme right of the car, like mm-hmm. pressing her hip into the seat handle.
Yeah.
Perrin is on the extreme left of the car.
God, I love that car.
I love that car. There is a creamy leather. There's like a meter and a half between them because they're sitting so far from each mm-hmm. other. And then at the breakfast scene, Mon is at the head of the table. Perrin is halfway down on one side. Mm-hmm. Leda sits right across from him. There's like four seats between Mon and her family.
Yeah.
And I think it really works visually, and it really works to show that the price that Mon is paying for rebellion is distance between herself and the people she loves.
Yeah.
Because she can't be vulnerable with them and she can't show them this part of herself. She has to hold them at arm's length. Mm-hmm. And all of the Coruscant scenes have been about this space. And then all of the Aldani scenes have been about this like claustrophobic closeness.
Everyone is up in each other's business. And I think that's the interesting part about Aldani. Everyone is in each other's dirty laundry.
They're gritty and grubby and smoky and digging through each other's stuff. And there's no privacy.
There's multiple times in this where Nemec is like diffusing situations by being like, who packed these explosives? And Cinta's like, I did. That's me. And then they're in the back chatter. They're like calling out numbers for how many charges should be in each satchel because they're checking and rechecking and rechecking. And Clem, being the new guy, has not gotten into the groove yet of like, welcome to the crap hole.
Yeah.
Population us.
Six, sometimes seven.
He's still a shiny.
Oh.
But I think Skeen trusts him now because Skeen's like, yeah, you've done time. And I think Nemec trusts him because he's like, honestly, it doesn't matter if you're doing it for money as long as you're doing it. Mm-hmm. Like the ideological purity of this corresponds with no one would do this for money unless they actually did in fact care. The money's like kind of an added bonus. And I presume they're all getting paid too.
Maybe.
I hope so.
Vel said that they have been eating roots and sleeping on rocks and do not tell anybody you're being paid to be here because they're going to want a salary too.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. It seems like having a big long-term payout. At least if you told me, hey, we're doing a rebellion and we need you to camp out in Space Scotland for however many months they've been there, like six.
And you'll have provisions.
Yeah. But you'll be surviving on milk. It's all a body needs. And you'll be drilling in a valley with sticks. And then you're going to pull off a heist. I'd be like, is there a paycheck attached to this? And they'd be like, yeah, it's like 50 grand. I'd be like, yeah, sure.
Really? I would think that the payoff is that when you get back to wherever your headquarters are and you pulled out this amazing heist mm-hmm. and you brought in presumably a lot of money, I'm going to hope it's a lot of money because the stakes feel very high for this mission. Everyone's treating it like a big mission. And I'm mm-hmm. going to be kind of bummed if it's not a big wad of cash. But I would presume that you get back to one of the bases, like where Tala brought Kenobi and Leia, and everyone gets to eat better for a while.
And you get to add it to your rebellion in resume.
Right, yeah, you get to add another notch to your belt. Everyone celebrates you as the hero of the heist.
And people are like, oh, you were on the Aldani heist. All right, we're looking for someone who can utilize an old school star path unit and figure out where to go.
Yeah. And it's not like you got paid for that, but it benefited the cause and the rising tide lifted all boats. You get to buy new supplies. You get better blankets. Everyone eats steak for a couple nights. And then you kind of move on to the next one. Maybe I was just conflating that with the rebellion in Kenobi.
No, I'm continuously reminded of like a warlord sitting there on a pile of jewels or whatever because they overthrew the dictator of an island. And the jewels are worth nothing, right? Because the warlord has to fight so hard to keep their power. And I wonder if that's just how the rebellion cells are operating now, is that they have this ideological purity. They're doing it to hurt the empire. They're doing it to try to gain support. But none of them have thought far enough ahead of what a post-imperial life would look like.
Nemec might have,
yeah.
I bet his manifesto covers like post-imperial rule of the transition period.
The thing about Nemec is that he's like the Thomas Paine.
Yeah!
Where he's like, the real problem is capitalism. And everyone's like, what even is that? He's like, look, the real problem is rich people. And the three richest people on the continent are like, but what if we throw off the king and become president? And he's like, I hate you guys. Like, I will sign on, but I'm not going to be happy about it. Because that's what happened in the American Revolution. George Washington was literally the richest person on the continent. And the idea of the problem is property, and it's that like the people who have the property make the rules.
If only
Thomas Paine was saying.
If only we had President Paine instead of President Washington.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Wow.
But
yeah, I just don't think that the six core rebels of Andor so far are in it for profit. And I don't think Luthen is either. I think he is using money as a tool to further the rebellion, so he mm-hmm. understands the importance of it as an incentive for rando outsiders that he's trying to inculcate into the cause. But I think he's hoping that Andor will get so looped in by the cause that he no longer needs to be paid to rebel.
I think that's a very valuable thing, and I think that's why he gave him the Kyber crystal, of saying it's don't accept less than 50,000 for it, and it's always worth more to me. For Luthen, he's working with such large sums of money that it matters a lot less, because he's sitting there and he's like, look, okay, how much does a bunch of blasters cost? Like 600 credits? Cool, deal. How much does like a squadron of X-Wings cost? Like 5 million credits? Okay, deal. How much does a bunch of blockade runners with attached A-Wings, how much does this cost? How much does that cost? Because he's the kind of person who's sitting there making sure that the ghost crew gets to eat.
Oh,
that Fulcrum gets like crates to move. And he's sitting there and he's buying from the huts and he's selling to the pikes and he's moving stuff.
That's Luthen?
Could be. Or people in Luthen's position as part of this loosely connected network of how do we plan these things out? How do we make sure that Deidre Miro doesn't catch us?
I hadn't thought quite far enough yet about how Luthen might be the guy.
If he's not the guy, he's definitely a guy.
Wow.
Like I said earlier, he's up there, and this is the kind of stuff that Fulcrum is doing as well.
So I just want to like nerd out for a minute about how great this is. Because so often I read a lot of sci-fi fantasy and a lot of like dystopian fiction, for example, is about overthrowing regimes.
Yeah.
And there's always this point, especially when I'm reading kind of more YA geared dystopian fiction, where great, you overthrew the regime. Now you have to run a country.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, because it's so complex, the detail is lacking, and I get really worried about, cool, you overthrew the government. What are you going to do next? And like, Star Wars is seeding their rebellion with these brilliant and capable people. When I look at Bail Organa, when I look at Mon Mothma, when I look at Luthen, I'm like, oh, okay, cool. I do kind of trust you to create a new government and run it and figure out what you're doing in a sustainable way. Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
What we're doing in Andor right now is also ideologically setting the seeds for the resistance movement like 30 years down the line.
What's the resistance movement?
That's in the Resistance TV show, the post-Endor era.
Well, clearly era I have stuff. Not yeah. seen it.
I just wish to point out for our listeners that much of the I joke, but not joke, about how the Clone Wars made the prequels good. Everything after the Clone Wars, Rebels, Resistance, Mando, Andor, Kenobi, is making the sequel era good by laying the groundwork for why this all makes perfect sense. And this level of how the rebellion has to overcome the ideological oppressiveness of the Empire, because everyone except for Nemec has internalized the Empire, shows why things are the way they are in the future.
Okay.
Nemec's the true hero here.
Oh, that might lead us very neatly into our Baywatch segment for the week.
Let's do it.
Yeah, you ready for Baywatch?
Sure am.
It's time for Baywatch.
All right. It's time for Baywatch. Who's your bae for Baywatch?
Well, you're either a prophet or the choice was just very clear this week.
Uh-huh.
I'm picking Nemec.
Good choice.
Nemec is amazing. Nemec got cut off by the show because they wanted to, like, joke about how Nemec can just go on and on and on about deep, abstract, philosophical rebellion concepts. And I was like, no, stop. Go back to Nemec. Pan the camera back. Inquiring minds want to know.
One of the things I love about Nemec is there exists a still extant but shrinking corner of geek culture of people who are like, let's radically recreate the concept of money. Let's radically recreate the concept of repairing your own stuff. Let's radically recreate the concept of books, of knowledge sharing.
Mm-hmm.
These are the people who invent BitTorrent and copylefting and 3D printers. This is Cory Doctorow's stock and trade. And that is a truly radical act to be like, I'm not even anti-capitalist anymore. I'm post-capitalist.
Yeah.
I live in the fully automated luxury gay space communism utopia that I create. And here's how. And here's the instructions. And please share the instructions with your friends. In fact, the files are self-propagating. And that's the kind of person Nemec is, because he's also the other side of being a geek, which is keeping a shotgun next to your printer. Because he's like,
Trust the machine.
If this thing tells me that my subscription has run out, I'm going to burn down an office building. And that's real fair.
Just go
honestly.
Office space on
it. If my printer subscription runs out, I'm taking the shotgun, and the printer is sinless. I'm going after the organization which caused that. And that is someone who looks at the world, sees injustice, and gets to the causes and conditions of that injustice and explores them and shares them, and then realizes that there are, in fact, fundamental truths.
Yeah, Nemec was, to me, anti-toxic.
Mm-hmm.
I think so often intellect, especially in the year of our Lord 2023, the chronically online intellect often curdles into something nefarious. And what I was talking about earlier about how the rebels just have time to think and fester and get paranoid and doubt each other, that is what happens to so many brilliant minds online. Like, they're so close to the point and then they miss it because the human brain is a victim of its own greatness, right? And Nemec is the opposite of that. Nemec takes all of this deep philosophical thinking about life and liberty and rights and government and the rights of the government and the rights of the people. And he gets to this ultimately affirming, validating, beautiful truth.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to toxic, dark, resentful bitterness.
The historical precedent for someone like Nemec is the Bronze Age shepherds who invented monotheism.
Oh.
Who were sitting there with nothing but time on their hands thinking about what the nature of reality is, because they're like, and here, sure enough, sheep everywhere. What do you know? Still sheep. The sheep have been counted. what is a sheep? You know, and they think about these things and they think about these things.
Why is a sheep?
Why is
a sheep? How is a sheep?
Who is a sheep? And that level with a little bit of intellect also leads to some of the greatest minds that history has ever known. And when someone refers to go touch grass, they refer to Nemec, who's out there. He's like, I have all the information I need. I've seen it all. I've seen the arc of history in a Marxist sense of like, this is how the arc of history is bent. Now I'm going to sit in the damn highlands
in
for
my
6 months in my cute hat. And I'm going to write a manifesto about it because there's nothing that is changing what I have seen. And he's also not being exposed to imperial propaganda anymore. So he's not even being co-opted. He is ideologically pure.
Nemec especially and the rebels generally are radicalizing me against the structures that keep our minds so busy.
Yes.
The way that social media is so addictive that when we as human beings right now have a moment to do nothing, mm-hmm. we just consume information instead of sitting in our hammocks and thinking, right?
Yeah.
I am getting so much about how our systems are in place to chain us. And how to push back against that in the name of love and light mm-hmm. and betterness for humans.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And I'm picking Nemec because he is amazing. And like, I am a little bit in love with him. And he you remind me so much of him and he reminds me so much of you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And just like he and the show are reminding me about how there are different ways to be, but you have to do it intentionally.
As far as a avatar of masculinity, I think Nemec is a very admirable one because you have Cassian who's hot and sketchy. You have Skeen who's not and sketchy. And then
he does have a six pack.
Yeah.
But a lot of gang tattoos.
Yeah. And then you have, you know, Tamarin who is there.
Tamarin is cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tamarin is steely.
He's steely and he also like knows what's up and he like once a decision has been made, he sticks with it, which is cool. But Nemec is a thinker. And I think and he's like the funny one and he's the bright one and he's just the joy of the whole group.
He is the joy.
He's probably the one who's kept them from killing each other this whole time.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I'm sorry. I just monologued about Nemec for like 10 minutes. Who's your bae?
Lieutenant Gorn.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very good.
Okay. I'm glad you chose Nemec because otherwise I was going to. But Lieutenant Gorn, he's going around. He's yelling at his people. And he's like, I am such a freaking straight edge hard ass that no one, first of all, would ever expect me to be the mole. And second of all, when I'm telling you to do something and then I'm like, oh, but I'll be a generous taskmaster and you can't actually go outside at 7:03 p.m. for no more than 3 minutes and look exactly that direction. Like, no, it's like,
He's got the reins so tight on them and commands such respect that even the illusion of going easy on them is enough. He's feeding mm-hmm. them crumbs and they're thanking him.
He's using the tools of oppression to overthrow the oppressor.
It's the opposite of Audre Lorde. I guess we're going to see how it goes.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that he's doing it out of lost love. And lost love is such a tragic cause.
It's such a powerful fuel.
Because when you see someone do something for love, you're like, oh my gosh, Romeo, Juliet, idiot kids. But when you see someone who's like, I'm doing it because they were widowed by the empire, like explicitly, you're like, oh, that person is never ever letting that down.
It's the difference between Anakin and Padme doing something for infatuation, which is mm-hmm. the Romeo and Juliet parallel of Star Wars, and Obi-Wan doing something for the memory of Satine.
Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't burn for him anymore as far as like it's burning him up. It is just fuel.
Mm-hmm.
It's banked. It's like a full fuel tank that he can burn whenever he wants indefinitely. Like, this is the time to do this. I'm sorry for you. I'm sorry that this is how this situation has worked out, because I have become relentless.
I have a nuclear reactor inside of me.
And there's nothing that's going to stop that other than my death.
Yeah.
So you better kill me.
Like, no wonder everyone hops to and cannot fart around while he's in their presence, because they're sensing this, like, burning wave come off of him. And they think it's discipline and devotion to the empire. And instead, it's that every minute he is burning to topple this entire thing down.
And he is disciplined. He's sitting there with the, like, watch captain on the top of the dam, and the watch captain's like, oh, those stinky Donnies are going to be doing this. And he's like, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just, like, listening and hearing. And he, every time someone talks to him, it adds to his just implacable movement towards rebellion.
They are just throwing more logs into the furnace. We're using a lot of different fuel metaphors
here.
This
dude's on fire, yo.
This dude's on fire.
So, yes, Lieutenant Gorin, love him.
Great choice.
And played very well.
Played beautifully. I love the way that the actor gets to explore the space. He's just all over Aldani.
Also, yeah, because he gets to hang out with the rebels, and also he's always in like the next set, you know? He's like, oh, I'll be hanging out in this set where the heist is going to occur. And he's like, he's there and he's a scene stealer. And also, like, that's important because he's there with a whole bunch of stupid mooks, you know, just a bunch of Imperial extras. And he's like, this is my scene. No one else really gets a scene to themselves.
Yeah, and he just sucks up all of the attention and light in the room. He's just that good.
You know, the more I think about, no one else actually does get a scene to themselves. You have Cyril and Edie are going back and forth, and they're both like, they're just stabbing each other and crying. Perrin and Mon Mothma. Clea is a powerhouse in this episode.
She's also, like, a scene stealer.
Yeah, despite getting like 8 lines.
She's so cool.
I hate seeing you nervous is such a, like, thing to say to someone. And then, you know, the rest of the rebels are all up in each other's biz.
But yeah, it's just Gorn who gets to really exist on his own.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, also a really poignant reminder that he is now alone. He does have the rebels, but he no longer has his lost love.
And he's, like, not really part of them, you know?
He is separate and apart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, that's a beautiful observation. Yeah. Man, I keep having this thing where I finish watching the episode and we sit down to do whatever, like we're eating dinner or we're reading books on the couch or I go take a shower, and I cannot stop thinking about the episode. Mm-hmm. And I have my Google Doc just up on my phone all the time because I keep having new realizations and new observations and new things to talk about and new questions. And I just feel so much more faith in the Star Wars machine because of Andor.
Wow.
It's the most confident Star Wars content that I've seen. It makes me feel secure that Star Wars is going somewhere and that it has a vision and it has a point of view. Mm-hmm. And, like, it's really done its homework and it's really thinking hard about what it's trying to do.
More than, like, in the season one Rebels finale when Chopper rides in with the cavalry and the song pulls in and it's just tears and explosions, more than the end of episode 3 when Obi-Wan and Anakin have their climactic duel, this is inspirational to be a good person, to look within, find the good within, and find the truth within.
It is relevant to our current struggles. Mm-hmm. It is intentional in what it's trying to say. And it is meaningful in what it is trying to provoke us to do.
Yeah.
Which is take back pieces of our lives that have been co-opted by capitalism and fascism.
And social media.
And social media, which are just tools of those regimes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is, in a way, kind of revolutionary.
speaking of social media.
Well, hang on. What are we watching next week?
We are watching season one, episode 6 of Andor, The Eye.
Yes! Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Oh, man. I've been looking forward to this freaking meteor storm for 3 episodes. Maybe 2. Feels like a long time.
Mm-hmm. It'll be exciting.
Anyway, where can the people find us if they want more Skywalker?
Look deep into your heart and write your own manifesto on where to find Star Wars. But also, if you want...
like on Apple Podcast as a review, if you like what we're doing.
Or any podcast app. I've been messing about trying to find new podcast apps because they just keep getting shot out from under me. Like I don't know.
Sam's really salty that Stitcher no longer exists.
Stitcher was quite good. And now it's all just like ad-fueled monstrosities. But anyway, you can find us on social media at Facebook, Instagram, Threads, the artist formerly known as Twitter, and
Patreon.
Oh yeah, Patreon, where we're watching Tartakovsky because we like going back. And boy, the second season of Tartakovsky Clone Wars is pretty fun, and we're also pummeling pell-mell through it.
It's truly beautifully done, and we are enjoying it. So we drop bonus audio content once a week on the Patreon. It's really fun. We let our hair down. We're wearing PJs. We swear. It's so great. I love the Patreon. This is a great time to join. If you would like access to all of our weekly audio content and our entire backlog of 2.5 years, you can join for as little as $3 a month. And that just helps us keep our equipment up to date, keep our subscriptions going, and bring you Growing Up Skywalker every Tuesday.
So send this episode to someone who is seeking.
Yeah. And like, send it to your cool revolutionary communist college friend that you haven't thought about in a while. And now you're like, ooh, that person was awesome. Mm-hmm. They should listen to this episode.
And send it to someone who is a teenager with parents who are bickering because one of them's a revolutionary and one of them's a hardworking and you're not sure which is which.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Court's out on that one. And we'll talk to you next Tuesday.
Bye.